Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, we have Moscow Mayor Nancy Cheney speaking about the police presence in Moscow Wednesday night as the ExxonMobil tar sands shipment came through, and we'll also hear an interview with Helen Yost of Wild Idaho Rising Tide and her companion, who are arrested after refusing to identify themselves sitting in a parked car while monitoring the first ExxonMobil split tar sands megalode late last Friday night. But first, these headlines.
This news brief brought to you by the International News Net.
Libyan rebel forces and armed civilians are rounding up thousands of black Libyans and migrants from sub-Sahara Africa, accusing them of fighting for Muammar Gaddafi and holding them in makeshift jails. Virtually all the detainees say they are innocent migrant workers. The African Union and Amnesty International have protested the treatment of blacks in Libya, saying there's a potential for serious abuse.
At least 11 people were reportedly killed by security forces across Syria Friday, as protesters promised, quote, death rather than humiliation. At least four occurred in Damascus suburbs. Three others were reportedly shot dead in the eastern city of Deir ez-Zor. EU governments Friday agreed to ban imports of Syrian oil in a move to apply more pressure on President Bashar al-Assad and his government.
Sri Lanka recently lifted wartime emergency powers but introduced new regulations allowing the state to keep imprisoned thousands of Tamil separatists detained under emergency laws. When the Tamil Tigers were defeated in 2009, the Sri Lankan government said it was holding about 12,000 Tigers.
The risk of an earthquake causing a severe accident at a U.S. nuclear plant has been found to be greater than previously thought. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission believes a quarter of America's reactors may need modifying to make them safer. The threat became real last week when shaking from the largest earthquake to hit Virginia in 117 years appeared to exceed what the North Anna nuclear power plant was built to sustain. The plant's two reactors are among 27 in the eastern and central U.S. The NRC review says may need upgrades because they're likely to get hit with an earthquake larger than they were designed for. Last week, rumblings at North Anna shifted two dozen spent fuel containers, which reportedly remained intact. The NRC found the plant was 38% more likely to suffer core damage from a rare, massive earthquake than appeared 20 years ago.
The U.S. National Research Council said Thursday debris orbiting the Earth has reached a tipping point for collisions, which in turn would generate even more of the debris now threatening astronauts and satellites. The council said NASA needs a new plan for mitigating the hazards posed by spent rocket bodies, discarded satellites, and thousands of other pieces of junk threatening 1,000 commercial, military, and civilian satellites orbiting the Earth. The world's first space collision occurred in 2009 when an Iridium communication satellite and a dead Russian satellite collided 490 miles over Siberia, generating thousands of pieces of debris. The crash followed China's destruction in 2007 of one of its defunct weather satellites as part of a widely condemned anti-satellite missile test.
For more details on these stories, visit innworldreport.net.
Washington State University President Elson Floyd has proposed merging the College of Sciences and the College of Liberal Arts as one way to cut costs in the face of further state budget cuts. WSU Faculty Senate Chair-elect David Turnbull, who teaches music, told the Daily News he does not oppose the merger, in part because half the public universities in the country already use that model. Turnbull said, "We don't have to try to reinvent the wheel. There's already a template that exists." Chemistry Department Chair K.W. Hipps told the Daily News he's not enthused about the consolidation, but maintains colleagues will continue to provide quality education whether the consolidation happens or not. Hipps said, "I don't think it's going to save any money, and I think from a chairman standpoint, it's going to make it harder to get business done." The WSU administration plans to hold open forums on the consolidation and a new budget plan that will likely go into effect in October. U.S. District Court Judge Justin Quackenbush in Spokane has ordered the FBI to build three bombs similar to the one Kevin W. Harpum of rural Stevens County is accused of planting along the route of the January 17th Spokane Martin Luther King Jr. Day Unity March route. Quackenbush said although the FBI has already detonated three mock-ups of the bomb at their headquarters in Quantico, Virginia, Harpum's defense lawyers were not informed. The judge said the new detonations are to be done in the presence of Harpum's defense lawyers in preparation for Harpum's September 12th trial. Public defender Kim Dieter said the previous FBI bomb components seemed cherry-picked and did not include the electrical wiring found in the backpack bomb Harpum is accused of leaving in downtown Spokane. The 37-year-old Harpum faces life in prison on charges of attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction, using a firearm to commit a violent crime, and committing a hate crime. Defense lawyers also plan on checking to see whether Harpum's father, 68-year-old Cecil W. Harpum of Kettle Falls, will be in any condition to testify at the trial. He was badly injured in a motorcycle crash August 6th and is said to be recovering in a nursing home or hospital. The Idaho Redistricting Commission is racing to meet a Sunday deadline to come up with legislative and congressional district boundaries for the state based on the 2010 census. The commission, consisting of three Republicans and three Democrats, were scheduled to reconvene at 3 p.m. Mountain Time in Boise this afternoon after a morning session where Democrats introduced five new maps that address Republican concerns about a megadistrict that would not include a connecting state or U.S. highway between the northern part of a district at Clark Fork and the southern part of the same district near Riggins. The connecting road within the district is required by a 2009 state law unless five out of six commissioners vote to rescind it. Democrats contend the new law is unconstitutional in part because it conflicts with a state constitutional requirement that district lines be drawn to split as few counties as possible. Three of the five Democratic maps viewable on the Redistricting Commission webpage would keep all of Latah and Benoit counties in a single District 6 and create a large District 2 that would wrap around four legislative districts and touch the Washington state line in two places, north of Rathdrum and south of Lewiston. District 2 on those maps would include all of Shoshone, Clearwater, and Idaho counties and a sliver of southern Bonner County. The other two Democratic maps would split Latah County, but not as radically as the Republican proposals have. The northwestern section of Latah County, consisting of mostly rural areas starting about 5 miles north of Moscow and including the city of Potlatch, would be in a district with all of Benoit and the southern part of Kootenai County. The rest of Latah County, including Moscow, would be in a district with all of Clearwater County to the Montana state line. This compares to the Republicans' preferred map, which split Latah County and the city of Moscow at a precinct line running along Morton Street and Public Avenue in Moscow and running 10 feet from moderate Republican Tom Trail's house on Mountain View, putting Trail and fellow Representative Democrat Shirley Ringo of rural Moscow in the same district as Representative Dick Harwood of St. Mary's. That district would include all of Benoit and Shoshone counties and parts of southern and northeastern Kootenai County. The Republican map would then put most of Moscow and a strip of Latah County that includes Genesee in a district that would include most of the city of Lewiston. Critics have noted Republican plans would put all eight of the Republican senators who voted against Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Luna's education overhaul in the same districts as Republican senators. In their Latah County split, freshman Democratic Senator Dan Schmidt would be in the same district as longtime Republican Senator Joe Stegner of Lewiston. The Redistricting Commission has until midnight Sunday to come up with a plan four out of six members agree on. They are also still debating the line between the first and second congressional districts. If they cannot agree on a plan, it will be up to the Attorney General to decide what to do next, and he can kick the decision back to the Redistricting Commission or send it to the state Supreme Court. Another possibility is a lawsuit from aggrieved parties scuttling the Redistricting Commission's decision, as happened 10 years ago. The Moscow-based environmental group Friends of the Clearwater has sent Keller Transport of Billings, Montana, a 60-day notice to sue, alleging the company has not done enough to clean up an area along the Lockshaw River where a tanker truck crashed last year. The truck traveling along U.S. Highway 12 dumped 7,500 gallons of diesel fuel near the roadway. Keller Transport is the owner of the truck that crashed. More than 3,000 gallons have yet to be recovered. The notice of intent to sue says the diesel fuel contains toxic levels of benzene. Friends of the Clearwater Ecosystem Defense Director Gary McFarlane notes the spill is on a river that falls under the federal wild and scenic river designation and is habitat for two threatened species, steelhead and bull trout. McFarlane said, "We think more needs to be done. We are hoping the letter will at least initiate a conversation about let's get this thing solved. Let's go and do the kind of cleanup the Wild and Scenic River Corridor deserves." The lawsuit is under the Federal Resource and Recovery Act. So far, cleanup crews dug a borrow pit along U.S. Highway 12 and recovered 4,100 gallons there, another 30 gallons of diesel was recovered with absorbent pads that were placed in the river. Another 260 gallons were collected by 40-foot deep recovery wells that have skimming devices taking oil off the top of the groundwater. McFarlane is calling for excavation under the highway to recover the oil, noting the road has been excavated after other fuel spills along the Lockshaw and Clearwater rivers. However, Gail Osborne of the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality's Lewiston office told the Lewiston Tribune testing has showed soil beneath the roadway is not contaminated. She also said it's just impossible to dig out the road right there. Nez Perce Tribe spokesperson Darren Williams sent a statement to the Lewiston Tribune saying the Environmental Protection Agency, which is overseeing cleanup efforts, should do more. The Washington Supreme Court ruled yesterday unanimously that Attorney General Rob McKenna can legally challenge the federal health care law signed into law last year. However, in the ruling, the justice said there's merit to the argument the governor has superior authority and could block the lawsuit. Governor Chris Gregoire was not a party to the case. Gregoire issued a statement yesterday saying she would not challenge the McKenna lawsuit. The statement went on to say, state law is clear that the Attorney General should consult with the governor before deciding to file an action on behalf of the state, and though that did not happen here, I am hopeful that will happen in future cases. McKenna is a Republican and is running for governor to replace Gregoire. Gregoire is a Democrat and is retiring this year. Representative Jay Inslee is planning a run for governor as a Democrat. We now turn to the first of our two featured segments. This is an interview with Moscow Mayor Nancy Cheney, who was on hand to observe both of the split megalode tar sands shipments ExxonMobil Canadian subsidiary Imperial Oil has shipped through Moscow and the police response. When the first load, weighing 314,000 pounds and taking up two lanes of U.S. 95, rolled through on its northward journey from the port of Lewiston to the Fort McMurray, Alberta area, it was met with dozens of protesters using the crosswalk at 3rd and Washington in downtown Moscow, and six protesters were arrested, including five who returned to the crosswalk after being physically removed by police. when the second load, weighing 233,000 pounds, came through town this past Wednesday night at 11:45. Police at first had said protesters would be allowed two passes through the crosswalk in front of the megaload convoy and would be warned each time and then would be arrested if they entered the crosswalk a third time. As the megaload approached, police changed their plan and said any person who enters the crosswalk in front of the megaload would be arrested. Police lined up and blocked crosswalks at 2nd and Washington, where most of the more than 100 protesters were. In the 2 hours leading up to the megalode's arrival, police fanned out around downtown Moscow in cars and on foot. I spoke with Moscow Mayor Nancy Cheney this morning.
Do you know how many police were deployed Monday night in the city of Moscow for the ExxonMobil tar sands shipment protests?
Not yet, but I've put in that request of the city supervisor who had a similar question. I asked him yesterday for that number for both Moscow police and Idaho State police.
And there's also, it seemed like a couple Latos County people there too as well. Okay, do you know who paid overtime, if there was any overtime for either the MPD or the Idaho State Police?
Well, it's my understanding that the Idaho State Police have an agreement with either Mammoet or ExxonMobil. Such an agreement was also solicited of the city of Moscow, and I'd ask that conversation be brought forward to City Council Administrative Committee at its first meeting in September. I think that's September 12th, if that's that second Monday of the month. So, you know, it's an ethical as well as a practical dilemma as to how to pay for police overtime. At this point, the City of Moscow and Moscow Police Department are simply keeping track of the additional hours, and the offer was made to have those additional costs covered by probably ExxonMobil. It wasn't explicit to me who would be writing whose name would be on the bottom of such a check. But, you know, for me it's kind of an uncomfortable situation when you are being asked to, protect the public safety and the interests of the citizens you serve, which is the objective of Moscow police and local government, but at the same time to facilitate that process which some citizens protest. So that will be an open conversation. I anticipate some animated discussion about it and public input as well.
From what you're saying, it sounds like the Moscow police know that ExxonMobil has made an offer to pay for overtime hours that have already occurred up till now due to protests because of the tar sand shipments, and I suppose they're also offering to pay future overtime hours. Is that your impression?
That's my understanding, but that hasn't been approved. And it's, as I say, going to be on the Administrative Committee agenda at its first meeting in September. So, we'll have the conversation. There are real costs incurred by this process, and is it fair that the citizens of Moscow bear those costs? I don't know. I mean, it's a really difficult conversation to have, but I think it's an important one to have.
Okay. Would you feel confident saying that there definitely was overtime or will be overtime paid as a result of last Wednesday to the Moscow police?
It remains to be seen who would pay for that. I mean, Moscow police definitely were there in numbers. And our policy is that however short an amount of time is put forward after one's regular work week, that there's a minimum of 2 hours compensation for overtime. You know, city always tries to support its employees in the sense of paying fairly for services rendered. The question in this case is who would write such a check. There has been no agreement made. There has been nothing signed that says we're going to send the bill to ExxonMobil. But I have heard some of our city council members express interest in doing that.
Okay, so you feel confident that overtime hours were worked by MPD?
Yes.
Okay, and that seems pretty obvious in the case of the Idaho State Police. We had one report, somebody said they saw 40 of them at once.
I don't think we have that many.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
It's my understanding that Idaho State Police are also pretty, you know, spread pretty thin in terms of their ability to cover the miles of state highway they have to cover in their regular work weeks. And so if it's an issue of staffing, you know, I think we want to make sure that the public safety is preserved, that our law enforcement personnel are not overtaxed in terms of their ability to work, you know, extra hours. I'm very respectful of the quality of service that was provided by all that evening. I mean, I don't think I needed to ask the question or give the direction, except for my own sense, but I did ask that city personnel be, you know, respectful and tolerant of people's First Amendment rights, and they always are. I mean, that's how they function, and I think we can all be proud of the way Moscow Police managed both of these circumstances with the mega loads coming through.
What do you think of the idea, well, the fact that the police, for an hour and a half before the megaload came through, was announcing that people would be able to use the crosswalk twice and get two warnings and only be arrested on the third pass, and then that being withdrawn about 15 minutes before the megaload hit town?
You know, I wasn't privy to that direction. I can't speak to it because I don't know what direction was given. Although I was present that evening, I wasn't there to hear that.
Okay.
Nor have I had a chance to debrief with Chief Duke on that particular situation.
And do you know what was the Idaho State Police the lead agency for what I guess they would call the incident?
Yes, you know, I think what I heard at the public input session, I think it was May 11th at the Hamilton Indoor Recreation Center, was that Idaho State Police had it covered, and basically, you know, if additional support were required, they'd let other agencies know. But the plan was for either ExxonMobil Imperial Oil or Mammut, the hauler, to make arrangements for flaggers at every intersection, and, you know, side road and those sorts of things, and then that Idaho State Police would be managing the law enforcement coverage as may be required.
Okay. Has a debriefing session with Chief Duke been scheduled?
Well, I always have the opportunity to talk with them. They always, the Moscow Police have the preliminary meetings and debriefing among their personnel immediately following. The other night was getting a little long for me, and so I didn't go into the police department for the official debriefing then, but I had a chance to speak with Chief Duke very briefly last evening at a function at the University of Idaho, and he and I will be chatting probably sometime this afternoon. We've not scheduled anything. I have, you know, he's always very receptive to my contacting him.
Okay, and I want to give you the opportunity. I guess there's been in the comment sections of the Daily News website that they were, you know, anonymous people who are claiming that you were at the protest as a protester or a supporter. But what was your purpose to visit the activities Wednesday night?
I was there to observe. I had some concerns. Certainly we want to provide for public safety. We want to make sure that people have a chance to, express their positions, whatever they are, in a democratic process. And that seemed to be the case, you know. So I was not there to protest or support this thing. I mean, I think I've pretty much made clear that I think the halls are a bad idea, and it's not something that I endorse. But I was there that evening and the previous time as an observer. I also observed last Sunday when another
A riot. That was a Riash transport out of Alberta?
That's right. And I did send an email to the Idaho Transportation Department yesterday about my worries that they would have authorized 4 over-legal loads to travel at one-hour intervals on Sunday night, Monday morning, when we had such fire conditions. I thought that was a dangerous circumstance to block a two-way roadway with these giant loads to say here we have tinder dry conditions, harvest season, we have wind and we have lightning and we have known field fires, and yet they've authorized closure of sections of the highway for intervals of up to 15 minutes. I did check with the Moscow Fire Department to find out if there were any conflicts, and they said although they had observed where the closures were, that they felt confident that if there were an emergency along that route at that time, they could have skirted the fire equipment past if the over-legal loads had, scooted off the edge of the highway in those two-lane sections. But I did weigh in with the Idaho Transportation Department to ask them to please consider weather conditions if they are to issue further over-legal permits.
And those, at least two of those 4 loads were two lanes wide, were they not?
That's right, yes.
That was Moscow Mayor Nancy Cheney on the tar sands megaload issue. Cheney also said she observed one of the 4 Alberta-bound megaloads going north just south of the city limits Sunday night and was told by a flagger she would have to wait another 15 minutes to continue traveling south because another load was coming through. These loads were smaller than the ExxonMobil split megaloads and are being transported by Riash for Krupp Canada to Alberta. The flagger keeping traffic waiting 15 minutes after the first load went through was despite an Idaho Transportation Department announcement that the Riash loads would be traveling 1 hour apart. Cheney and members of the Moscow Sustainable Environment Commission expect a letter from the Sustainable Environment Commission to be on the agenda at Tuesday night's City Council meeting. The letter asks the City Council to rescind its earlier position statement that welcomes and encourages the megaloads to move through Moscow. The letter also requests information from the Idaho Transportation Department concerning knowledge and plans for increased use of US 95 as an industrial corridor through the area and to issue a new position statement that reflects the concerns, desires, and sustainable efforts of the City of Moscow and its citizens. Among other things, the letter says, quote, the City Council accepted explanations from ExxonMobil representatives at face value without diligent questioning. It says at another part, the City Council's position statement did not acknowledge, let alone take a moral stand, on the significant local and global issues inherent in the exploitation of the Alberta tar sands project. In another part, it says the position statement made by City Council intimates that there are potential financial gains for businesses in Moscow, while the reality is that there is little likelihood of any business gains due to these megaloads going through Moscow.
KRFP, Moscow.
Now we move to our second featured segment, an interview with Helen Yost of Wild Idaho Rising Tide and her companion Cece, who were arrested after refusing to identify themselves, sitting in a parked car while monitoring the first ExxonMobil split tar sands megalode late last Friday night and early Saturday morning.
So we are following the megalodes. I can't say exactly where we caught up with them, but we just heard from an observer up in the tented Deschmet area that they actually left early. So we had a hard time catching up with them.
What do you mean early, before 10 p.m.?
Before 10 p.m. These particular observers were sitting at the place where they were parked at 10 p.m., and they were already long gone. And they saw, before they even got to the place where they were stopped for the night, they saw progressions of cars coming at them. So they assumed that the megalode had already, you know, blocked traffic up the way a bit, and that these cars were oncoming traffic that had been led around.
And now the Idaho Transportation Department permit says they can only travel between 10 p.m. and 5:30 a.m. Are there exceptions for the northern part of the route?
No, we have not received yet, even though we shelled out $232.50 for public records from ITD. We have not received an actual updated permit and transportation plan. But what has been quoted by ITD, by their communications manager, Adam Rush, has been that, yes, indeed, the permit is only good between 10 p.m. and 5:30 a.m. on the nights that it's scheduled to travel.
Okay, well, let's talk about your monitoring and you getting pulled over.
Well, we had stopped after passing the megalode convoy twice at about milepost 421 on Highway 95. It was about midnight, 12:30 on Friday night. That's midnight or 12:30 Saturday morning.
Kootenai County?
We were in Kootenai County at that point. And so there were four women sitting in a parked car, pulled a ways off the road, certainly over the white line. And we were in, there was two of us in the back seat that were about to reach over and grab some food for the driver as requested. And we're going to pass that food forward. And then all of a sudden, an Idaho State Police trooper pulled up really rapidly next to us and then around us and jumped out and started asking all kinds of questions, and immediately noticed that us two women in the back seat weren't wearing our seatbelts, and pointed that out, and we said, well, it's a parked car. Do we have to have our seatbelts on while we're parked? And then when we both refused to produce our IDs, and we stated that under Idaho state law, in the recording of this interaction, that under Idaho state law, we don't have to give an officer ID if we're passengers in a vehicle, he proceeded to ask us to step out of the vehicle, cuffed us, and put us in the back of the first trooper car, and then, of course, another one arrived on the scene for the second arrestee.
Okay, and Cece's with you today, and she was the other person in the back seat. Tell me why you were told you were arrested.
I was told that I was arrested, but I wasn't actually told why I was being arrested. I think the clear question that I was asking them is if I was going to be arrested, and I was told that I needed to produce my ID. I told them I didn't have my ID, so they were asking for my name, and I told them I wasn't going to give them my name, so that's why I was arrested. Again, I kept repeating over to the officer that I didn't commit any type of crime, so there was no reason for me to have to cater to their needs if I didn't do anything wrong. I mean, we were literally sitting in a car.
Let me just put this straight. If you refuse to give me ID, and mm-hmm. I find that you have ID, mm-hmm. you're obstructing. Okay?
Okay.
If you give me a false name, that is obstructing or giving me false information, mm-hmm. both of which are arrestable offense. Mm-hmm. Okay? Is that really worth it for a possibility of a $10 seatbelt ticket? Is that really worth it?
I took off my seatbelt to get her a drink.
Well, that's what she said, but I did not see you have your seatbelt on. I didn't see her have her seatbelt on. He had his. I'm sorry. She had hers. That is also not legally warned. Okay? But right now I'm talking to you.
Right.
So, what do you claim your name is?
I don't claim my name.
You don't claim your name?
No.
Are you refusing to give me identification?
I am refusing to give you my identification.
Can I ask you why?
Because when I am a passenger in a car, under Idaho state law, it is not, I don't have to give you my ID.
Okay. Well, if you're violating the law, what would that be?
I am sitting in a car.
Trying to wear your seatbelt?
When it isn't moving without my seatbelt, and I'm a passenger, that doesn't have to give you my ID.
Okay. Oh, here, yeah, I have my charge card.
Because
my other one had the pockets that went the other way,
yeah,
and it didn't quite fit, and I thought, oh, this way will be easier, and it turns out
when I was sitting in an unmoving car, yeah, I did not have my seatbelt on.
Okay. Hold that for a second.
I did have my seatbelt on when I was there.
Okay. You two go ahead and step out right now, ma'am.
Why?
Because I'm directing you to step out. You're refusing to give me ID because you didn't have your seatbelt on. You need to step out of
the car. In the car that was not moving.
Okay, it was moving when I stopped you, was it not?
No, we were already pulled over when you pulled over behind us.
I don't think so. Step out of the vehicle.
I owe you neither ID.
Okay. I did not see you have a seatbelt on. I'm asking for identification.
I have a seatbelt on now, all right?
Are you refusing to give me identification?
I am a passenger in a car. I am abiding by the law, and I don't have to give you my ID.
Yes, you do. If you're not wearing a seatbelt, step out.
Step out of the car.
The next stop is jail.
Why? I didn't do anything wrong.
You're not wearing your seatbelt. That is against
the law. I'm not in a moving car.
Step out.
Go ahead and get out of the car. You are under arrest at this time.
Because?
For obstructing a police officer. Get out of the car.
You guys are impossible.
When were you eventually told what the charge was against you?
I actually wasn't told, ever. I got a sheet of paper afterwards that I looked through again today. At first I looked at it and I didn't see anything on there, but it says that I violated statute 18705, which is obstructing an officer. But I was never told that. Apparently people who called the station were told, but I wasn't personally, neither was I offered a phone call or read my Miranda rights or said nothing was ever told to me about a lawyer or watching what I say or anything like that. I wasn't offered a phone call until almost 12 hours after we were booked. Well, we weren't booked, but we were waiting in a cell to be booked.
At what point did you give a police official your name, or did they get your name?
At 8 o'clock the next morning, around 8 o'clock the next morning, I finally produced my legal name after much harassment.
What do you mean, harassment?
Harassment as in cops were coming in and using different tactics to intimidate us by telling us that bad things had happened to the people that we rode with and that bad things were going to happen to us, like we were going to get held indefinitely, that they were going to hold not myself only but Helen as well, as long as I didn't give them my legal name. They yelled and screamed and got all red in the face.
Actually screamed, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of people actually screamed at us, yeah.
So how many people were in the cell with you from police when this was going on?
It was no more than two police officers at a time that were in our cell at any given time.
Were you separated from Helen?
At one point we were separated, yes.
And they still were yelling and screaming at you at that point?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah, sounds like, you were illegally arrested. What was the situation with bail? Like, just go through the whole situation until you got released.
Well, we, of course, among ourselves were trying to figure out which steps we should take next as we were jailed, to most effectively protest this both while we were in jail and, of course, when we get out. I asked what bonding was when they said, oh, are you ready, to book. Mm-hmm. They asked what booking was, or you can erase that whole part. So first they were pushing me to actually book out. And so I asked an officer, what is booking? Because I didn't understand the process. And that's when they started getting irate and saying, oh, well, if you refuse. And I said, no, I just asked, what's the process? They were really hustling me to book out and essentially leave CC behind. And I said, no, I'm responsible for my ally, and I'm not going anywhere. I'm not leaving this jail until she leaves with me. And that was during the point when they did separate us. But then it was a busy Friday night, and there was plenty of drunks to check into the jail, and so they ended up putting us back together in the same cell. And we did not book until many hours after CC finally released her full name, and you know, it took them a couple hours to get the records together so that we could actually book out. And, of course, you
can't actually contact people on the outside to look for some kind, to post bond or look for some kind of assistance until after you actually book. And so we didn't do that until maybe about 10 that morning, and then we finally were starting to make calls in that next hour or so after that. And amazingly, many of our calls made it through. I had to be at work that night and called my employer three times, and it sounded like I got through, but they never received that. So we wonder, you know, how much of our phone messages were actually getting out to people. Of course, from jail, you can't call cell phones. So we had a very difficult time even reaching out to our community working on this issue.
Interestingly, between the time that we were first approached by a police officer and the time we got to make phone calls, obviously, like Helen said, you have to be booked first, so there's a series of, you know, questions and information that you're required by law to give if you want to make a phone call at all. During that period of time, like I said previously, we also weren't read our Miranda rights or anything else like that. So basically all of that information that we were giving in between those two times was uncounseled as to what was going to be done with that information. So that was something that was very interesting. As far as bail goes, I myself am transient. I'm homeless, and I'm a migrant farm worker, so I'm from time to time going without cash, and that was one of those times. So I was very inquisitive as to what exactly the bond process was going to be if I couldn't pay, and it was really difficult to get information out of the police officers as to, like, how long I was going to be there if I couldn't bail myself out. At first they said they could hold me indefinitely if I didn't cooperate with them, and that a judge could say that I could be held until I cooperated, which could be, they said, forever, which I doubt, but so there was that, and then slowly I began to understand that I would just be held until I could see a judge on Monday. But during that whole time, I was under the assumption that because I couldn't pay bail, that I could essentially be held indefinitely in jail. Mm-hmm. So given false information, according to what it's like for someone who's penniless in jail.
So do you want to say who eventually bailed you out?
Yes, actually, it was a very valiant effort by the entire community here in Moscow. So the woman we were riding with is she's very outgoing in her communications, and she got a hold of activists in Spokane and Coeur d'Alene who were working with us on this issue that night, and they got word out to the press, although it's not all completely accurate information. And then also she got a hold of other folks in our network, I believe it was mostly Cass Davis, who made the rounds requesting funding, perhaps at Farmers Market. I haven't spoken enough with these people about what happened while we were in there. But three groups of people pitched in solid amounts to get us out of jail. There was Gina McHale and Fritz Knorr, also Diane and Bill French. Bill had been arrested the previous night in the protest here in Moscow against the megaloids coming through, and also Gary McFarlane and his partner Bobby. And then also the Wells provided some gas money, and we stopped to have some food on the way back to Moscow. I had imposed upon myself hunger strike without any food or water for the entire time we were there, as I don't trust jail food, and so we stopped to have something to eat.
Okay. Are you implying that when the police were yelling at you at the cell, in the cell, that they were implying that the other two people in the car might be also arrested as well, or?
Well, no, they said something at one point about how, and they described the make and model of the car had been impounded, and we suspect it was false information, but then they retracted it after a while. Come to find out, the driver of the car was actually given a $46 ticket for, you know, parking on the side of the highway somehow, you know, not rightly, but we...
But, yeah, they were on the other side of the white line, right?
We were well off the highway. So as far as we can tell, all of our activities on the side of that highway were completely legal, and we do believe that we were already set up to be arrested for whatever they could find, in that the second time that we took off from an earlier parking at the side of the highway, some mysterious white SUV-type vehicle pulled up really rapidly behind us to the point where we thought we were going to get rear-ended while we were sitting there. It was flashing its front lights on and off. and you know, almost like sort of nudging us from behind. They're not actually touching the vehicle. And it made it very difficult for us to get back on the highway, which is the last time we were on the highway before we pulled off and this whole scenario unfolded, just because of all the bright lights behind us. So we were already being harassed by vehicles in the convoy before these state police officers further harassed us with various bogus and just infringements of the law, supposedly.
So the SUV was part of the convoy?
As far as we can tell, it was, yes. But, I mean, it was such a scary moment, so it was hard to tell. We didn't, you know, follow the convoy and then look for that particular license plate, but we figure that's what was going on.
Okay, so the implication seems to be that the police want to imitate or intimidate monitors so they won't follow the megalodes, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that statement. I think that this was very obviously not only facilitated by the police department, but the entire convoy. Maybe not the entire convoy, but most certainly like the flaggers that are there directing traffic, and the police are all working together to try to point out the people who are monitoring and prevent them from being able to effectively follow, trace, and record what is going on while these megalodes are being transported north.
So you think they have things to hide as far as the legality following the rules of this transport? You already mentioned that they seem to have left way before they were allowed to by the travel permit.
Oh, yeah, there's various evidence that this has been ongoing, both on Highway 12 and Highway 95, that, you know, they break the rules, but then the rules are changed, not just by them, but for them, by our state officials, both in the Idaho Transportation Department, and then, of course, their illegalities, if you want to call them that, trespasses of their agreement to break the law, which is the transportation plan, they're just facilitated by our own Idaho State Police. And I think the situation that we encountered when we were arrested the other night just goes to prove that, you know, it's almost as if ExxonMobil arrested us, in that they are paying our Idaho State Police to work these overtime hours to escort the load, and then Idaho State Police arrest citizens that are trying to make sure that our highways are used in an appropriate and safe fashion. It's really bogus that our state police have essentially been co-opted by one of the larger corporations in the whole country, or in the whole world for that matter, and that they are, you know, these corporations have their own police force in the police that should be safeguarding our safety and convenience on the highways, as well as looking out for damage to our infrastructure. It's a definite conflict of interest. This shouldn't be going on. Our own state police should not be engendering the bad habits of a multinational corporation.
Any thoughts of a civil rights case against the police?
Oh, definitely. They messed up so many times, and this whole procedure is like almost, we wonder if they were asking for it. Perhaps they understand the contradiction of values and of loyalties in this entire case, I wouldn't be surprised if they, maybe many of them, don't want to actually be facilitating the damage that's going to come from these megalodes, both here in Idaho and at their destination up in the tar sands.
But they weren't nice to you at all, even for a minute.
There was no niceness about it. I think this was perhaps premeditated, and it was very, you know, very just done very operationally without really much emotion involved. I think they were looking for ways to get us one way or another.
Anything? Yeah.
Despite the fact that we were monitoring and abiding completely legally, and in fact not even obstructing the whole process of what was going on, simply there recording what was going on, we were referred to at the police department as the protesters. So your previous question about whether or not this is being used as a method to specifically intimidate monitors, I believe that might be true, but I think more broadly that there is no distinction between people who are monitoring and people who are putting their bodies in front of blockades at this point, at least by the police department. I think that the entire group of people who are protesting this transport are considered nuisances and are at this point being asked, without being directly asked, to stop.
Were you at the civil disobedience early Friday morning? Did you observe that in Moscow?
I actually was hitchhiking from Portland for 2 days to get here, and unfortunately, that second day was the day after.
Okay. I just sort of want to wind up, because I think we have maybe everything about the monitoring issue, but I haven't talked to you since the Friday morning protest in Moscow, the civil disobedience, at least not on tape. So do you have any comments about that, Helen?
It was an outstanding turnout. It was good to see. There must have been at least 200 people, maybe not all in one space, on Washington Street here in Moscow. People are really irate about these loads coming through this town and trampling our good consciences about not wanting to see tar sands development and all the damage that's going to do to native folks in the region, the tar sands, as well as wildlife and water and air and entire ecosystems and global climate change and all of that. But it was just very heartening to see there was a good dozen people that sat down in front of that megalode. Now, not all of those were arrested. Some were dragged off to the curb. Our Moscow Police Department, I got to say, handled it well, although we did see tempers flare among that force, and of course it seemed to some of us that there was a bit of undue force imposed on some of the monitors that were actually jailed, or some of the protesters. Now I'm getting confused just like ISP. and there was, you know, a good 50 people standing behind the people sitting in the crosswalk, and it was just a great show of solidarity just within our community and beyond, in that there are tar sands protests going on in Washington, D.C. right now. At least 50 people are getting arrested every day in opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline.
Even with a hurricane?
I don't know. Maybe they called it off for a day or two. But just the fact that there was an earthquake in that vicinity and now a hurricane, I think we have a little bit of backing from all good old Mother Nature. And of course, you know, this is only going to amplify. You know, we're privileged and honored to be at the front lines of stopping the tar sands, literally with our bodies here on the supply line to the tar sands. Of course, these components that are going through are going to be built up into a giant processing plant that spews the number one point source of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere, the number one point source in all of North America. It's a mess, and people understand it's a mess and that we should have developed alternatives decades ago, but of course the competition has been squashed by the big oil companies who have paid well many of our government officials on every level. It's time for the people to rise up and stand for cleaner energy, and we're just really glad that it all started happening here in somewhat rural Idaho, and it's spreading all over this continent. If that Keystone Pipeline gets approved, and of course the final environmental impact statement did come out here sometime this last week, there's going to be protests all over the place. You know, there's going to be people you wouldn't normally expect, perhaps you could say the same here in rural Idaho, rising up all across the Midwest physically, you know, confronting the construction of this pipeline, like we have the megalodes here in Idaho, and there's backing of our particular issue here all across the Northwest. I suspect we're going to see a lot more protests and a lot more monitoring as these megalodes try to make it from the Pacific Rim countries into Alberta. There could be protests. Well, there already has been, although not direct confrontations with the megalodes in Portland and all other places in the Northwest, and several ports are going to be used here pretty soon, not just 95. Other roads are also going to be very much blocked and become a police state by these megalodes coming through.
That was Helen Yost of Wild Idaho Rising Tide and her companion Cece, who were arrested in the back seat of a parked car while monitoring the first ExxonMobil split megalode during the second night of its journey up U.S. Highway 95 from the port of Lewiston to the Alberta tar sands. The interview was recorded Sunday. That's it for this special edition of the KRFP Evening Report. If you want to help KRFP keep evening reports like this on the air, plus the reports you hear during Morning Mix, and the public affairs shows and recordings of local events, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $25 for students. You can become a member by sending your check to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can check out how to donate on the Radio Free Moscow website. Tune in for a special holiday edition of the Evening Report Monday at 5:30 and the next regular edition of the Evening Report Tuesday at 5:30. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a great weekend.